Okay, thank you very much, Ibra. I have an hour, I'm told, right? Till one. Oh, you took away 6 minutes. Okay. I'm not good at sticking to time frames even when I have them. I'll do my best. And the truth is, in addition to the three levels that Rabbi Blau mentioned, there's at least one or two other major levels in which we could talk about Shemitah. And that is that there's a lot of philosophy in Shemitah. There's a lot of philosophy in the mitzvah itself. And there's also a lot of philosophy, or what you might call a meta-halacha. As Rabbi Blau indicated, the question of how to run a modern state, al-pi halacha, this is since long before the state of Israel even, since the earliest days of Zionist settlement, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, this has been a very, very, very major question. And there's a lot of meta-halachic issues, or a lot of philosophy about how each one of us interacts with that. I'm going to try to do as much of this as I can in 1 hour, so I'm going to just touch on the philosophy of Shemitah itself only for a few minutes at the beginning, even though it's really worth a full hour shiur in its own right, and focus more on the practical aspect. But the soundbite for the practical aspect is not, and this is the statement I want to open the shiur with, and by the end of the shiur I hope I'll be able to make clear to you what I mean by this. But I don't know how many of you, whenever it was you realized that you were going to be in Israel for the Shemitah year, I don't know if that was the minute you got off the plane, or 2 weeks after you got to the plane, or 2 weeks before you got on the plane, or a few months ago, but at some point or another, I assume you all discovered that the year that you were planning to come to Eretz Israel to learn is the Shemitah year. I'm not sure what kind of reactions that generated. I certainly have spoken to many people who were not happy about that, who found Shemitah to be some sort of a burden of one type or another, either a source of religious tension and fear, I don't know how to keep this mitzvah, and I don't know what I'm going to do about it, or just annoyance because it's going to get in my way, and people are telling me that some of the restaurants that I like to eat in, maybe I shouldn't be eating in, or I should be, and everyone's arguing about it, and I don't really understand. I hope that by the end, you'll be very, very excited that you had the fortune, as I did. My first time I came to Eretz Yisrael also was when Rabbi Blau and I were in yeshiva together, was a Shnat Shemitah, and already then, I was able to understand, thanks to some teachers I had, that it's a tremendous privilege to be able to be here during a Shemitah year, to be able to be part of the observance of a mitzvah that for a couple of thousand years has basically been a theoretical concept. People studied about it in Batei Midrash, but even the Jews who lived in Israel over the centuries, here in the old city of Yerushalayim, one of the few places where there was a Jewish community hundreds of years ago, it still had very, very little practical relevance because they weren't farmers. And today, we have the privilege of being part of the observance of a mitzvah that for thousands of years has remained sort of an abstract concept. And that's something to be very excited about and not something to be worried about. I hope I'll manage to get that across to you. But the soundbite that I wanted to start with is the question is not, and we're going to see that there's a major machloket that's been for already 120, basically for 126 years, there's been a major machloket about this. And the machloket continues. And you'll ultimately have to make whatever decisions you make with whatever halachic guidance you get about how to deal with that machloket. But the soundbite is, the question is not how are you going to keep the mitzvah of Shemitah or how am I going to keep the mitzvah of Shemitah. This is not, although you're going to come across this most directly when you have to decide what food to eat, what food to buy in a supermarket or in a restaurant or in any other situation. But it's a mistake to think about this as an issue of kashrut. This is not the same type of question you have when you decide to know whether there's a burger joint up the block and whether it's okay to eat the meat in that burger place or not. Maybe it's not mahajin, or it is mahajin, or it's glatt, or all the various other issues that come up in kashrut. This is fundamentally different than all of those issues, even though you're going to face it in a similar type of way. But the reason that it's fundamentally different is that the question here is not how you or I are going to keep this mitzvah. The question is, how is Am Yisrael going to keep this mitzvah? It's not a mitzvah for the individual. It's a mitzvah for the nation of Israel as a whole. And the question that you and I have to ask ourselves is, what am I going to do to contribute as best as I can to the Jewish people's observance of this mitzvah? And once you think of it in those terms, it becomes a fundamentally different kind of question. If I have a hamburger, and it's machloket, whether I'm allowed to eat it or not, so the question is, do I take the stricter halachic opinion or the more lenient halachic opinion? And that itself could be a major discussion. I'm not minimizing that. But that's not the question here. The question is, how are my actions going to impact on the Jewish people's observance of this mitzvah? So let's start with the most basic concepts. And again, I'm going to do this very, very briefly. But I think it's important to understand the idea of what the Torah was hoping to accomplish by the mitzvah of Shemitah. And although many mitzvot we can philosophize and it's sort of hard to understand what exactly the Torah wanted, I think here the Torah itself in the Psukim makes very clear what this mitzvah is about. Let's take a look. The mitzvah of Shemitat Karka, Shemitah as it applies to agriculture and things that are grown in the land, is discussed only twice in the Torah. There's one pasuk, basically, or two maybe, in the book of Shemot, and about six pasukim or something like that in the book of Vayikra. Let's start with the pasuk in Shemot, but I gave it to you, the first source on the page. I deliberately gave it to you in the context of a few pasukim around it, because I think it's important to see the context in which the Torah presents it. This is Perek Chav Gimel, the book of Shemot. That's Parshat Mishpatim. Parshat Mishpatim talks about what? What's the basic theme of Parshat Mishpatim?
Laws.
What kind of laws specifically?
Interpersonal.
Can we get even more specific? What types of interpersonal laws? You're correct. Parshat Mishpatim discusses the type of things, what? Things that may have to do with business or money, the type of things that somebody might sue somebody else over. It could be business, or it could be I smashed into your car and I say it was your fault, you say it was my fault, or whatever. Those types of matters, things that wind up in a courtroom. And at the towards the end of all those laws, the Torah says, Lo tate mishpat evyoncha berivo. The Torah here is speaking to the judges, the ones who are making those decisions when a case comes before them. And the Torah says, don't pervert justice when it comes to a poor person. Even though he maybe, you know, he couldn't hire a good lawyer or whatever, doesn't matter. Midvar sheker tirchach, make sure you stay away from lies. V'nakib et tzadik al taro, ki lo atzdik rasha. Make sure that you don't wind up perverting justice and having an innocent person, God forbid, be executed. V'shochad lo tikach, don't take a bribe. And even if you say, well, I'll take the bribe, but it doesn't matter, I'll make the correct decision anyway. What's wrong? The guy's offering money. The Torah says, no, ki ashochad yaver pichim yisalef divrei tzadikim. Once you've taken a bribe, you can no longer be objective. The ger lo tilchatz, don't take advantage of immigrants or strangers or people that are in one way or another weak and easy to take advantage of them. Don't do that. And you should know better. Batem yadatem et nefesh hager, ki gerim ha'item be'eretz Mitzrayim. Okay, so if we would push the pause button on these psukim right now, it's very clear what's going on here, right? We have a series of laws that's talking about how to have not just justice when there's a case between two individuals, but how to have a just society where people know that when they go to court, that they're going to get a fair hearing, and it doesn't matter if they're wealthy, it doesn't matter if they're important, and a person who's entering the society, who's weak and sort of helpless, knows that he's going to be treated fairly. And then the Torah makes what at first glance might appear to be a sharp left turn, or right turn, I don't know which direction, but a sharp turn, and starts appearing to talk about something completely unrelated. V'sheish shanim tizra et artzecha v'asafta et tivuata. For 6 years, you should go out to your fields and plant in the land. And then, after a few months, gather the crops. V'hashvi'it, but in the seventh year, tishmitena unitashta. Here we have two little bit difficult words here. Let's look at them one at a time. Tishmitena, what word do you see there? Shmita. What does that word mean literally? Anyone know? Lishmot lahashmit. What does it mean? Sorry? Not exactly to move away, but to release. Right, to release. Right? Ani machzik achshav et haniyav, im ani mashmit oto, if I release it, it falls. That's called lahashmit. Okay? Unitashta. That's related to the word kilo yitosh Hashem amol. What does that mean? Kilo yitosh Hashem amol. God will not forsake or abandon his people. God will not abandon his people, but we are supposed to. Unitashta. So now let's look at that pasuk again. The previous pasuk said, for 6 years you should plant in your land and gather its crops. The hashvit in the seventh year, tishmitena unitashta. You shall release it and abandon it. It being the land that you planted it for the other 6 years, you should release it. Tishmitena unitashta. Release it and abandon it. Walk away. Just walk away from your land. And what's going to happen if you walk away? V'achlu evyonei amecha. You walk away from the land. You abandon the land. And who's going to come in instead? Who's going to eat the fruits that you're not eating? Well, we'll get to animals in a minute. But first it says v'achlu evyonei amecha. What's an evyon? Not an animal. On Purim we give matanot le'evyonim. Poor. Right? Poor person is going to come in. The poor are going to come in and take from the field. The Yitzram, and if the poor people leave things over, then tochal chayat ha-sadeh. Then the animals can come and take it too. Kein taseh lechar mechal zeitecha. We'll talk about that more in a few minutes, the difference between a field where you grow crops and an orchard or a vineyard where there are trees. But it says here it applies to both of them. Okay, if I would have shown you these psukim and only these psukim, and this was all first time you ever heard of Shemitah, and we just read these psukim, what would you assume the reason for this mitzvah is? What's the idea here? What does it sound like? Especially in the context in which it appears.
Social justice.
Right? We just talked about having a society where everyone gets a fair hearing in court and where people are treated well and the poor and the weak and the disadvantaged are also taken care of. So it seems that this is another form of charity. For 6 years, I own the land, right? I'm the landowner. So for 6 years, I get to harvest the crops. Once out of every seven, it's given to the poor. It sounds like it's a form of charity, social justice, something along those lines. Now let's turn to the second source. These are Psukim in Vayikra. First of all, you'll notice the word Shemitah doesn't appear here at all. It has a different name. But it's clearly the same mitzvah. By the Be'er Hashem Moshe B'Har Sinai Le'mor, the Be'er B'nei Yisrael V'Matah Lehem Ki Tavo El Ha'aretz. Here we see this doesn't apply, as Rabbi Blau said, in Teaneck or Scarsdale or Holland or anywhere else outside of Eretz Yisrael. Ki Tavo El Ha'aretz. Asher Ani Notem Lechem V'Shavta Ha'aretz Shabbat Lashem. Here it's not called Shemitah, it's called Shabbat. Shabbat Ha'aretz. And who's it for? For God. It's not for the poor people, it's for God. Here this appears not as a social justice law, but as a religious law, right? And it's called Shabbat. Just like I have a Shabbat every 7 days, I apparently have a Shabbat also every 7 years. Sheishanim tizra sadecha, v'sheishanim tizmor karmecha. Here again we have that duality. We have fields where you plant crops like grain, like wheat and barley, or vegetables, versus a kerem. A kerem is a vineyard. Grapevines, if you don't know, I don't know how many people have actually seen a grapevine. That's why when I take people on these tours, they finally understand what these things look like in real life. A grapevine is a tree. And therefore, there's a fundamental difference, practically speaking, and therefore also halakhically speaking, between a field and a tree. Let's imagine that I have a wheat field, and I have a vineyard, right? What do I have to do in the wheat field every year in order to get crops? And actually may not have to water it, maybe enough to wait for rain. Right, you have to plant. At the beginning of the season, the farmer has to go out and plow the land and plant seeds. And then either you water it artificially or HaKadosh Baruch Hu waters it with rain, and then it grows. And then you harvest the wheat, and the next year, what do you have to do?
Plant
again. On the other hand, if you have trees, right, I have grapevines, right? And I pick the grapes off the vines, what do I have to do next year? So there are things I do have to do. You have to prune it. You have to cut the branches off the tree. And that's also something that we can show people when we take people and see these things. You have to cut the old branches off the tree to get the new grapes to grow. If you don't do that, you're going to get very few grapes. But fundamentally, the tree is there. It doesn't need to be planted. And that's going to have a major effect on the laws of Shemitah we'll see in a few minutes. But in any case, the Torah here discusses both types of situations. We have a sadeh and we have a kerem. Okay? And so, sheishanim tizra sadecha. For 6 years, you should plant the seeds in your field. V'sheishanim tizmor karmecha. And in 6 years you should do the parallel action, that which is necessary to get grapes out of the vineyard, namely, to prune the branches. V'asafta tivuata uvashana shvi'it. But in the seventh year, here again, it doesn't say tishmetena. V'ashana shvi'it shabbat shabbaton yel aret shabbat lashem sadcha lo tizra v'charmecha lo tizmor. Don't plant in the field, don't prune the vineyard. That sounds very similar to what we were told in Shemot. In Shemot, we were told, walk away. Don't work the land. Etzviach kitzircha lo tiktsor. Vet invei nizirecha lo tiktsor. And then, after you did nothing in the beginning, you didn't plant in the field, you didn't prune the vineyard, but then things are going to grow anyway. Probably nowhere near as much, but some grapes are going to grow. And even if you don't plant in a wheat field, you will get some. You will, if it's a field that wheat has been planted in, let's say, for the last 6 years, and when you harvest, there are seeds that fall down. Even if you don't plant, and even if you don't plow, you're going to get some crops. Those are called tzvichim. Here you see the word etzviach kitzircha. That's an important word we'll see, because it's an important halacha of Hilchot Shmita that's based on that word. So here it says, etzviach kitzircha lo tiktsor, don't harvest that which grows on its own. Vet invei nizirecha lo tivtsor, and don't pick the grapes that grow on the vines. Shabbat shabbaton yehi el'aretz. Okay, so if we look at this pasuk, we have here, it sounds like how many prohibitions? How many things we're told here not to do? Two? I see more than two. I see four. What are the four? Oh, I'm sorry. It's really two psukim. I said in this pasuk. You're right. I meant in the two psukim together. Maybe that was, of course, a mistake. You're right. Sadcha lo tizra. Don't plant in the field. Bekarmecha lo tizmor. And don't prune the vines in the vineyard. Et tzfiach kitzircha lo tiktzor. Vet invein izirecha lo tivtzor. In other words, we have the Torah addresses both the sadeh and the kerem, both the field and the a vineyard, the thing with trees, or a sdei ilan, as Chazal call it, a field that has trees in it, versus a field that has crops in it. And in both cases, we're told, in each of those two scenarios, we're told, don't do the activity which is designed to bring about crops, namely, don't plant seeds in the field, and don't prune the vines in the vineyard. And then, a few months later, when things grow anyway, we're told, don't harvest them. Et tzfiach kitzircha lo tiktzor, that in vain zirecha lo tivtzor. Those are the four Isurim, we'll see in a minute, those are the four Melachot de'oraita that are prohibited in Shemitah. But then we're told something that sounds... Yes?
Can you repeat that one more time?
In a minute. We're going to come back to it later. Okay, but before that, the next Pasuk might seem a little strange to us. It then says in the next Pasuk, V'hayta Shabbat ha'ayetz lachem li'ochla. L'cha u'la'abdecha v'lamatecha v'schircha l'toshevcha agarim imach. The Shabbat Haaretz, which is what it's called here, the Shemitah year, the Shabbat of Haaretz, it should be for you to eat from it. For you, your slave, your male slaves and female slaves, your employees, the people that live among you, including the strangers, and even l'vehem techa v'lechaya asher b'yatzecha, and even for your animals and even for the wild animals, just like we saw in Shemot. But what's a little strange about that pasuk based on what we saw before? What were we told we're not allowed to do? We're not allowed to plant or prune, and we're also not allowed to harvest. And what are we told in this pasuk that we are allowed to do? To eat. What's strange about that? Let's say it was not Shabbat Ha'aretz, but what's called Shabbat Bereishit, the regular Shabbat. Okay, regular Shabbat, also harvesting is one of the 39 melachot of Shabbat, is kotzer. Right? You're not allowed to harvest, not from a field. I have outside my house a lemon tree. Right? So picking a lemon off the tree is a malacha on Shabbat. If I didn't pick the lemon on Friday afternoon, and now I want to eat a lemon on Shabbos afternoon, not too many things you can do with a lemon on Shabbos anyway, let's just say. So, I'm not allowed to pick it off the tree. And therefore, bottom line is, can I eat from the lemon on Shabbat? No! If I didn't pick it before Shabbat, I can't eat from it. Because I can't. What am I going to do? I'm going to eat it on the tree? Can't do that. And you can't pick it off the tree. So, you might have thought that the same thing is true in Shemitah. It says that you can't harvest the crops, but then it says, Vayta Shabbat Ha'aretz Lachem Le'Ochla, that you can eat from it. So in a minute, we're going to have to see what that means. There's obviously some sort of, if you're allowed to eat from it, you're going to have to be able to harvest it in one way or another, just one second, and therefore the Isur Ketzirah here cannot be the same as it is on Shabbat. It has to be somewhat different. But in any case, just to wrap up the introduction and a little bit of philosophy, and then we'll start talking about the halakhic application, there's some sort of harvesting that seems to be prohibited, but there's also something that's permitted. In the end, Vayta Shabbat Ha'aretz Lachem Le'Ochla. You're allowed to eat from it. So, who's allowed to eat from it? In Shemot, it sounded like, if I'm the owner of land, in Shemot, it sounded like, what do I have to do? Remember it said in Shemot, Tishmetena Unitashta V'Yachlu Ev Yonei Amecha. Right? It said you're supposed to walk away from the land, and who's going to come in and eat instead? The poor people. But here it says, Vayta Shabbat Ha'aretz Lachem Le'Ochla. Lecha, for you, and also for your slaves, and also for the people living nearby. In other words, it's not that you can't eat from the field at all, it's just that you're no different than anybody else is. You walk away, the poor people can come in, the animals can come in, you can also come in. But you have no greater rights here than anyone else does. Well, again, we'll see the halachic manifestation of that in a moment. But just for a moment, again, I could spend the next half hour on this point, and I'm fighting myself not to, because I have to get to the other things. But is this mitzvah here, now that we've seen Shemot and Vayikra, is it a mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro, or is it a mitzvah ben adam l'makom? What's the obvious answer? It's clearly both. It has to be both. In Shemot it's presented one way, in Vayikra it's presented another way. Okay, but the same mitzvah is actually one and the same. By the way, here's a little homework. Take a look at the Aseret HaDibrot, the mitzvah of Shabbat, the fourth commandment. Take a look at the way it's presented in Shemot, Perek Chaf, I believe. I look at Perek Hei of Dvarim and see the very same mitzvah presented very differently. And you'll see the same duality. In Shemot, it's key. Sheishet yamim asa Hashem et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz v'chulei. We keep Shabbat to remember that God created the world. In Dvarim, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say a word about that. It says, "Lema'an yanuach avdecha v'yamadcha kamocha." In Dvarim, it says that the reason for Shabbat is, again, it's a social law. It's to make sure that everybody has a day off. Right? Something very, very relevant. If you follow the Israeli news, they're fighting about this now in Tel Aviv. This exact issue. The city of Tel Aviv is trying to allow stores to open on Shabbat, and the people fighting it are not religious Jews that are trying to keep observance of Shabbat. The people in Tel Aviv that are fighting it are secular Jews who want to go to the beach on Shabbat, but are saying that if you keep stores open, we're going to have to work 7 days a week, and we want to be treated the same way as our wealthy guy who owns the store. Okay? So that's obviously not the full observance of Shabbat, but those things are there. So both Shabbat Ha'aretz and Shabbat Bereshit have this duality in there. And again, I think there's a lot of philosophy in the fact that the same mitzvah is Ben Adam L'Makom, Ben Adam L'Chavero. And perhaps the real message is that the two are one and the same, and you can think about what that means at some other time. One last point, and then I'll take questions, and then we'll move into some of the details. There's another aspect of Shemitah that I'm not going to dwell on now, but it's important to understand. Because everything we've spoken about so far applies to people who own land. Now, once upon a time, or at least who work on the land, or at least whose livelihood in some way is connected to things that are grown from the land. In ancient times, and not just in such ancient times, until probably about 150 years ago, until the Industrial Revolution, probably around 80% at least of the people in any society, anywhere in the world, were in that category. Right? Most people were farmers or had something to do with farming. And therefore, when the Torah spoke about not farming the land for a year, the Torah was basically telling the entire economy to shut down for a year. That's what it meant. There were always a few people, though, who weren't farmers, even in ancient times. Today, most of us aren't farmers. But even in ancient times, there were some people who weren't. Every village had a shoemaker. There were people who were shepherds who take their sheep out to graze in the mountains. There were people who built homes or made things out of clay, etc. And if you weren't a farmer, you were... which is most of us nowadays, in the old days those were a small percentage of the population, then Shemitah might have nothing to do with you. Right? You don't plant seeds and plow and prune vineyards in the rest of the years either. The only impact it's going to have on you is it's going to be whether there's vegetables and fruits and grains in the shuk that you can buy to eat, and also you might have a problem that if no one else is working, no one's going to come into your shop and buy anything because they don't have any money. But fundamentally, Shemitah doesn't apply to you. There's an aspect of Shemitah that applies to everybody. It applies even in Chutz La'aretz, by the way. And that's what we call Shemitat Ksafim. Part of the idea of the Shemitah year is that everyone has to help everybody else out. And the Torah here, I'm not going to read them inside for lack of time, but if you look at the last source on the page here, the Torah speaks about giving loans during Shemitah year. And the Torah is speaking there particularly to the few people maybe who have money. And everyone else is coming to them and asking for loans. And the Torah says at the end of the year, you're going to have to release all the loans and no one's going to have to pay you back. And not only that, but they're going to come to you during Shemitah year and ask for loans, and you're going to say to yourself, Karva Shnata Sheva, Shnata Shemitah, what am I crazy? The guy's asking me for a loan, and in a few months it's going to go away. I'll tell him to come back, and the Torah says, you're not allowed to do that. In other words, the message here is that Shemitah applies to everybody, and we're all in this together. That's what I said at the outset. Right? The entire society takes a year off. This is what Shemitah is meant to be. An entire society that takes a year off from what they do the rest of the time. For 6 years, we all have to work very hard to make a living, and it's very competitive, and everybody's working hard trying to make a buck, and that's not bad. That's what the Torah wants us to do. It says, Shei Shanim, that's what you're supposed to do. But just like every 7 days, we have to take a break from that, and turn off the computer, and turn off all the devices, and shut down the stores, and shut down the offices, and spend the day with our families, and spend the day with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and make sure that our workers also have a day off with their families and a day off with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. So every 7 years, the whole society is supposed to shut down like that. This is and basically, most people aren't going to do very much work. There's going to be a lot of time, a lot of free time, a lot of time to sit and learn Torah, a lot of time to do a lot of other things. Everybody's going to be equal, the rich and the poor, there's no difference. The few people who have money are going to have to lend it to everybody else and be in there. And the only thing that is going to be very difficult is we may not have any food or to eat. And the Torah recognizes that, and the Torah realizes that this is going to be a great challenge. And so therefore, if you look at the second paragraph in source number 2, the Chitom rule, let's say you ask a very simple question. Let's say you say, you know, this is a really beautiful idea, that we all take a year off every 7 years, and we shut down the economy, or at least we put it into a major slowdown, and we don't have to have all the competition we usually have, and I don't have to spend late nights in the office or early mornings in the farm, and we can have like shiurim during the week, and everyone can sit and learn Torah, and everybody's equal, it's beautiful, and everybody's allowed to take from everything, and we're all in this together, but there's just one tiny little problem. The chitam rule, let's say we ask a simple question. Manocha! Bashana shvit! What are we going to eat? Hein lo mizra, v'lo nesov etvulatenu. We can't plant, we can't harvest the crops, we're all going to starve. It's a very basic question. Let's say I told each one of your parents, take a year off from work and come to Yerushalayim to learn for the year. Sounds like a great idea. It's only one tiny little problem. And let's even say your parents went to their boss and said, listen, I want to take a year off for the year. And the boss says, no problem. Take a year off. I'll even, here's a contract. You can even have your job back. I'm going to hold your job for you. But the only thing is, don't expect a salary during your sabbatical year. Right? By the way, that's, if you've heard of the term sabbatical, that teachers and others get, is where it comes from. Right? There are some people that, thank God, are very wealthy and can afford to do that. Most people might love to do such a thing, but can't afford to. Now imagine I told the whole country, we're all going to do that the same year. We're just going to shut down all the businesses. For a year, we're going to open up all the batei medrash, and we're all just going to take a year off from work, and afterwards we'll come back and do it again. What's going to happen? We're all going to starve. That's what the Torah knows we're going to ask. And the Torah addresses it. It's one of the only places in the Torah, where the Torah, maybe the only place, here and in Dvarim, when it talks about Shemitah, and it says, if you're worried about keeping this law, God says, trust me. I'm going to give you a special bracha. There'll be enough food from the sixth year to last you through the seventh and into the eighth year until the next crops are in. Okay. First of all, there was a question that I... No? Yeah.
You said the three prohibitions for Shemitah in regards to trees, that not to plant the seed, not to prune the tree, and not to harvest the crop.
Not to harvest the crops of the fields or of the vineyards. And in a second, I'll talk to you about what that means, because I point out there's an apparent contradiction. Okay, so this is the concept. It's a beautiful idea that, as we'll see in a few minutes, the Jewish people probably never fully lived up to in ancient times or in modern times. And we're not fully living up to it yet either. It remains an ideal that we have to strive for. But these are some of the major messages that are behind the Mitzvah Shemitah. Now, what does it mean in practical terms? Yes?
Is the Shemitah depending on the sixth year having double crops?
It's not dependent on it. The Torah promises that if we keep the seventh year, the crops from the sixth year will last long enough. But it's not like you could say, oh, it didn't happen, and therefore we don't have to keep it.
How would you know the seventh year?
That's a great question. That's a great question. And not only that, historically, we know for a fact that it didn't always happen. I'll get to this in a few minutes, but we have historical evidence in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash of situations where people made great sacrifices to keep Shemitah. And you know, one of them happened right here up the road. Okay, in the time of the Maccabim, right? The time of the Chashmonai, the second Beit HaMikdash. So you all know about the liberation of Yerushalayim and the rededication of Beit HaMikdash that we celebrate every year on Chanukah. What you may not know, and if you look at the historical records from the time, like Sefer Chashmonaim Aleph and Josephus, is that just a year or two later there was another battle that we almost lost. We actually did lose. And the Greeks came back to Yerushalayim and were about to recapture the Beit HaMikdash. And at the last second, there was what you might call a miracle, that they had a problem in Syria and they had to pull their army out and they cut a deal with Yehuda Maccabee, a ceasefire, and we basically lost control of Yerushalayim, but were able to keep the Beit HaMikdash. According to Sefer Maccabim, which is a historical work, that year was a Shnat Shemitah. And the reason that they couldn't withstand the siege was because they didn't have any food. And they almost lost the... Now, you could look at that and say, the Torah promised the bracha, and they almost lost the war because of it. Or you could say, but in the end, they were miraculously saved by, you know...
I'm saying, in terms of Pikuach Nefesh, Shemitah becomes secondary.
No, Pikuach Nefesh, that's not necessary, Shemitah. We'll see the question of Pikuach Nefesh came up. It doesn't say here that you have to die. The Torah says, keep Shemitah, and everything will be okay. What happens if I'm in a situation where there's a real fear that people are going to die? So this is no different than any other mitzvah, that Pikuach Nefesh allows the mitzvah to be overridden. And that happened both in ancient times and in modern times, that question was raised. And the question wasn't whether it's okay to violate Shemitah for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh. The question was simply to evaluate whether we were dealing with a situation of Pikuach Nefesh or not.
Okay, which there's no double crops in the sixth year. How do you expect everyone to survive in the seventh year?
It doesn't necessarily say you're going to have double the crops. It says the crops in the sixth year will be sufficient to last you through the seventh year.
All right, so two-year crops...
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. Yes?
What's the more practical question on the terms Pikuach Nefesh and Shemitah? Let's say you have people who really need it, but they can't get to a certain orchard or vineyard. But can you harvest it for
them? That's a great question, and let me come back to that in a few minutes. Because that question and the solution to that question is the basis for one of the major halachic devices that we use nowadays called Otsar Beitin. Okay? So I'll get back to that in a few minutes. But first, let's just try to understand. Again, obviously, you could spend months learning Hilchot Shvi'it, and let's just in 5 or 6 minutes try to get an overview to what these laws are, practically speaking. There's two aspects of these laws. There's the aspects that apply to the farmers or to people who own land, and then there's the aspects that apply to all of us. The aspects that apply to the farmer, I'm going to spend only one sentence on, because they don't really apply to us, if we're not farmers. But we said that there are 4 melachot that are prohibited. However, there's also the permission to eat from the land. And therefore, the prohibitions of zriah and zmira, the prohibitions of planting and pruning, those prohibitions are absolute. The prohibitions against harvesting the crops cannot be absolute because we're told we're allowed to eat from the land. And therefore, the way the halacha understands this is that you're allowed to harvest the crops, but not in the normal way. Some poskim hold that means that it has to be done with what we call a shinui. The Chazon Ish says, it's based on the Rambam, I believe, that the primary prohibition is not the manner in which you harvest the crops, but the quantity. That's what does a farmer normally do? The farmer comes, when the time comes to harvest the crops, he hires a bunch of workers, and they go through today with tractors, in the old days with animals, and they just harvest the entire field systematically. They pack everything up into huge, huge packages. Some of it goes to the marketplace, some of it goes into warehouses, etc. That's what you're not allowed to do. What you are allowed to do is go into the field and pick a little bit for yourself and your family. And that's true whether you are the owner of the field or whether you are not the owner of the field, because in the Shemitah year, nobody's the owner. And that brings us to the second aspect of Shemitah. Oh, before I get to that, though, there are only 4 malachot, or according to one opinion, 5 malachot, that are prohibited from the Torah. However, the rabbis, Midrabanan, added a whole bunch of other things. Anything else that's going to help the plant grow, for example, irrigation, watering plants, is a malachot Rabbanan in Shemitah. Fertilizing, weeding, etc. All these things are malachot Rabbanan. The Chazon Ish counted 22 different malachot Rabbanan that are found throughout Masechet Shvi'it and elsewhere in Shas. But there's a very important difference between Malachot Doraita and Malachot Durabana. And here we can see in the Rambam, if you look at source number 3 there, Mitzvah Aseh L'Shvot Me'avodat Ha'aretz V'Avodat Ha'ilan. Notice the Rambam also differentiates between these two categories of the field and the trees. Shenemar B'Shavtar Shabbat L'Hashem, etc. Okay, and now look at Halacha Bet there. Ein Elokim min HaTorah Ela Al HaZriah O Al HaZmirah V'Al HaKtzirah V'Al HaBtzirah. Those are the 4 things that are mentioned in the Torah. Planting in the field, pruning the vineyards, and harvesting the crops of the fields, and harvesting the fruits of the trees. Those 4 things have a punishment of Malkot, because it's an Issa D'Oraisa. But then he writes, in Halacha Chet there, in the second paragraph, and inside that, mashtim beit hashlachim b'shvi'it. If you have a field that's ordinarily watered, if it's an irrigated field, and I just told you that watering plants is a malacha derabanan, so you would think you can't water the field. Here it says you can. Mashkim beit hashlachim b'shvi'it. V'hi sadeh hazri'ah shetzme'ah b'yoter. A field that is very, very dry and needs water, or else the crops are going to die, or the trees are going to die. V'chein tzdei ilanot. Same thing. He says you're allowed to water the plants. And the reason for that is, he says in Halacha Yudim, if you don't water the plants, ta'aseh ha'aretz milecha v'yamot kol eitz sheba. If you don't do this, if we don't allow people to do certain malachot rabbanan, then all the plants in the entire country are going to die, all the gardens are going to dry up, all the fields are going to be messed up, and the country is going to be brought to desolation, and that's not what the Torah wants. So therefore, there's a fundamental distinction, this is crucial, halacha maaseh in the fields, between melachot d'oraita and melachot d'rabbanan. The 4 melachot d'oraita, namely planting and pruning, and harvesting in the ordinary way, those things are prohibited under all circumstances, but everything else that's prohibited is prohibited only, what's called in Aramaic, le'ivruye ilana. If the melach is being done in order to make things better, to make the plant more beautiful, more luscious, to give it extra fruit, etc., that's prohibited. But if it's le'ukme ilana, which means in Aramaic, if it's just to prevent the plant from being damaged, that's permissible. And therefore you can water not just fields, but you can water gardens, right? I don't know, here in the Old City, I don't know how much of it you see, but in where I live, and Rabbi Blau lives, and Alon Shavuot, even this week already, I've seen people doing gardening. Gardeners are working, and that's completely permissible, as long as they know what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. You're allowed to water the plants, you're allowed to mow the lawn, you're allowed to, under certain conditions, pull out weeds, everything has to be discussed, and people that have gardens have to learn these halachot, but it's not that you're not allowed to do anything. Okay, that's as far as those who own land is concerned. Those of us who don't own land, or don't work the land in any way, have no direct contact with those laws. But there's a second aspect, and that goes back to the pasuk in Shemot. In Shemot, we were told that Shvi tishmetenu nitashtat. You have to abandon and walk away from the land. And that means that in Shemitah, anything edible that grows during Shemitah, fruits, vegetables, grains, in theory at least, is hefker. Anybody's allowed to take it. And it's permissible to be eaten by everyone. One of the fundamental mistakes people make, people think sometimes that if it's from Shemitah, that it's not allowed to be eaten. I think the kashrus organizations create this problem because they write sometimes on kashrus labels, it'll say you'll buy a product or something and it'll say, Lelo chashash tevel orla v'shvit, right? And tevel and orla are things that are prohibited. And it tells you that you don't have to worry, there's no tevel and orla and then nothing here comes from Shemitah, and maybe that's part of the reason why people think that things that grow in Shemitah are not permitted. It's not true at all. The Torah said, "Baitash habat haaretz lachem le'ochla." According to Ramban, it's a mitzvah asay to eat them. We don't pasuk in that way. But it's certainly permitted to eat it. And basically what's happening in Shemitah, the very end of the psukim there is it says, "Ki li haaretz," God says. The land belongs to me, and therefore you're not allowed to work the land every 7 years to remember that the land belongs to me. And therefore, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to us, "Baitash habat haaretz lachem le'ochla," it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving us directly. When we eat the perot shvi'i, when we eat the fruit that comes from the land during Shemitah, it's a gift that's given to us directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore it has kiddushah. And this is the term that Rabbi Blau mentioned at the outset, kiddushah shvi'it. Things that grow during the Shemitah year are permitted ba'achila, they are allowed to be eaten, and they are holy. And this is a very unusual concept for us, because there are many types of holy foods in Halakha. And every single one of them, with the single exception of Shemitah, is usher to us nowadays. Because in order to eat holy food, whether it's truma, whether it's maser sheni, whether it's netar revai, whether it's kodshim, any of these types of holy foods, there are various restrictions. Some can only be eaten by kohanim, some can only be eaten here in Yerushalayim, and all of them, except for Shemitah, can only be eaten with tahara. If we're tameh, we're not allowed to eat. We're not allowed to eat maser sheni, we're not allowed to eat truma, we're not allowed to eat netar revai, we're not allowed to eat any of these things. And therefore, since today we're all tameh, we don't have the parah duma, therefore we can't eat any holy foods, with one single exception, shvi'it. And there's a whole philosophy about that also, which I'm holding back from not going into. But that's also worthy of philosophical contemplation, just one second. Okay? So because of that, this is something that on the one hand is very foreign to us, and that's probably part of the reason that people get so scared of it. But on the other hand, it's an incredible opportunity. None of us has ever eaten the Korban Pesach. I hope we'll be able to this year. But until now, none of us has ever... Nobody here is... Anyone here over 2,000 years old? I didn't think so. So none of us has ever eaten a Korban Pesach. None of us has ever eaten Maser Sheni, hopefully. But we have the opportunity to eat Perot Shvi'it. So on the one hand, that's a little bit scary maybe. But on the other hand, it's an incredible incredible privilege.
You're saying that we can eat...
Give me a second, because this is still quasi-theoretical. We'll get to the practical. We're moving towards the practical. But fruit that grows... Okay, let's take my lemon tree, okay? I picked all the lemons on the tree before Rosh Hashanah. Now there's no lemons on the tree. And God willing, in the springtime, new lemons will grow. And those lemons are going to have kedushat shvi'it. Okay, so first of all, I'm not allowed to take all the lemons off the tree. I have to hang up a little sign telling everybody who walks by that they're allowed to take lemons off the tree. Anyone who wants to can come in and take lemons off the tree. You'll see signs like that, I'm sure, here around the old city. People here have trees in their yards and stuff like that. You'll see them in other places also. Not now. Fruits on trees only when they start to grow during Shemitah, which means only around Pesach time will there be fruits on the trees, and even more towards Shavuot, fruits on the trees that can be eaten. And those have kiddushat shvi'it. Anyone's allowed to take them. And when you take them, you're allowed to eat them, but there are restrictions because they're holy, because they don't really belong to us. They belong to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, so there are certain rules. The most important rules of Torah, the Torah says, "Baitash habat haaretz lachem le'ochla," and Chazal learned out, it's quoted in the Gemara, "Le'ochla v'lo lehefseid." You're allowed to eat the fruits of Shemitah, but you're not allowed to destroy them intentionally. Okay, so you have to be a little bit careful with them. So for example, Rav Kook writes in his Sefer Shabbat Haaretz that if you have wine that's made from perot shvi'it, so you can use that wine, but you have to be careful not to intentionally destroy it. Why would you intentionally destroy wine? Well, for example, there's a minhag that probably most of us observe, that on Saturday night when we make Havdalah, right? After making havdalah, there's a minhag to take the, pour out a little of the wine from the cup, and to take the ner from the havdalah and extinguish the ner in the wine, right? It's such a minhag. Obviously, that wine, after you extinguish the candle, and you can't drink those few drops of wine anymore. The rest of the time, we don't consider that bal tashchit because it's some sort of minhag. Whatever the basis for it is, I don't really know, but I assume there is such a basis for it, probably in Kabbalah, if I had to guess. And therefore, it's considered an acceptable usage for wine the rest of the time. But Rav Kook writes that if you have wine that has kiddushat shvi'it, so you're not allowed to observe that minhag with that wine, you have to blow out the candle a different way because you're not allowed to destroy peirot shvi'it intentionally. Yes?
So if you accidentally spilled it,
so then it was spilled. If it's possible, you know, see people sometimes, you know, if you spill onto a plate, people will try to like lick it up or something like that. I don't know how crazy you have to go over this. But you're not supposed to intentionally destroy it. And the fear, but that's part of what goes on here. People are so afraid of doing that they wind up not using it anyway. But you have to realize something. If we all say to ourselves, okay, I'm afraid maybe I'll spill it by mistake and therefore I'm going to just avoid it. I'm going to get wine that doesn't have kiddushat shvi'it. And a lot of people wind up doing that. So there's two issues. First of all, again, we could have a major philosophical discussion. This is why I'm so excited about Shemitah, because it raises so many very fundamental issues. Each one of these is worthy of an hour-long discussion in its own right. Is that philosophically the way we're supposed to live or not? Are we supposed to be afraid of kiddushah and avoid it so that we don't wind up violating it? Or maybe we're supposed to embrace it and take the risk of violating it. But besides that, that's true when it comes to you personally. But let's say we all make that decision. The Torah said, La'akla b'lova has said, and therefore we're so afraid of accidentally destroying it that we're not going to go anywhere near it. So what's going to happen to all the peirot shvi'it? They're going to stay on the trees, and what's going to happen to them? They're going to all rot. So you could say, but I personally didn't do anything. But I'm Yisrael, the whole point is it's supposed to be by Tasha Batarif Lachem L'Achla V'Lola Hefseh. So if we don't make wine out of it, because we're afraid of spilling the wine, and we let all the grapes rot, so what have we accomplished? Right? We're back to the same story. That's part of what I meant when I said this is not about you and me, it's about Am Yisrael. So maybe Adarabba, maybe we should make it into wine, and we should buy it, and we should, or not buy it exactly, we should get a hold of it in a legitimate way. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. And then we should be careful with it. And we're human beings. So someone's going to spill wine. And when it spills. Right? Okay. Let's do this, because I have now like 13 minutes. We'll hold the questions. I'm happy to, did they have lunch right after this?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm happy to stay here after the Shira until there's no more questions. Okay? But I'm sure not everybody wants to stay for all the questions, so.
You're also invited for lunch if you want.
Oh. Depends what's going on. We'll have to. Okay. So, where was I? Okay. So, the Akhla Velo Lehetzeh, there are also certain other people. You should know a Chumrah. You should know that this is a Chumrah, and therefore, if one is not capable of doing this for various reasons, it should not prevent one from using Peirot Shvi'it. But there's a practice that you'll see in people's houses that, let's say you have, right now, the fruits that we're buying are still from the sixth year. I told you, fruits have to start growing during Shemitah to have Kiddushat Shvi'it. So you're not going to have fruits with Kiddushat Shvi'it until at least around Pesach time. But the halacha is that vegetables that, even if they grew most of the time before Shemitah, if you pick them during Shemitah, have Kiddushah. So a vegetable that was picked already on Tzom Gedalia earlier this week has Kiddushah. And just a few days ago, we started to get, I have in my house right now, tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers, with Kiddushat Shvi'it. There are already zucchinis out there with Kiddushat Shvi'it, and pretty soon we're going to start getting other things also in a couple of weeks, onions and carrots and potatoes and things like that. So let's say there's some leftovers. Someone made a salad and we tried very hard to eat the whole salad, but there's some, you know, my 4-year-old didn't finish it, whatever. There's still some food left over. Or, you know, I cut off the tip of the cucumber and the actual tip that can't be eaten has no kedusha, but maybe there's some of the cucumber that you know, it's hard to cut off exactly. If you have pieces of peirot shvi'it that aren't going to be eaten, so you're not supposed to just directly destroy them. So you're not supposed to throw them directly into the garbage. If you have it in your garbage can, like, you know, all kinds of disgusting stuff, and then you throw the Shemitah fruits right in there, so then you're, by throwing them into the things that are unedible, you're going to basically destroy them. So you'll see in people's kitchens, you'll see people have like a little container of some sort that might even say on it, Kiddushat Shvi'it or something like that, and they'll put the leftover fruits or vegetables in this case, in there, and they just let them sit there until they rot on their own, and then you tie up in a plastic bag or something and throw it away. That's a chumrah. You don't have to do that. If you're, let's say, walking in the street with, Rabbi Blau mentioned an apple, right? You're eating an apple in the street, and, you know, so the actual core that can't be eaten has no kedusha, but it's hard to know exactly when you got to that, and when you're ready to throw away the apple core, there's probably, you can probably take a few more bites from it. So you should not take that apple and throw it directly into a garbage can. But that doesn't mean you have to carry it around with you all day until you can bring it home and into your dorm room or whatever it is. You could simply put it into a plastic bag of some sort and then put it into the garbage can. Therefore, if someone really wanted to, they could pull it out of the garbage can, open up the plastic bag, and it would still be edible. We assume no one's going to do that. And therefore, eventually it'll rot on its own. And you didn't use it as much as you could, and then you didn't destroy it. There's a few other halachot that apply to Kedushat Shvi'it also, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into them. So again, I'll take questions afterwards. Let me just spend the next few minutes getting to the really practical stuff. As was mentioned, Shvi'it has always been difficult for Am Yisrael to keep. If you open up your Tanakh to the very last page, the Mamash, like four psukim before the end of Tanakh, it tells us, but the reason that, after the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the reason that we went into exile in Bavel for how long? 70 years. The reason, according to the very end of Sefer Devar HaYamim Bet, is because we didn't keep Shemitah, apparently 70 times, and God said it's based on Psukim in Yirmiyahu that are themselves based on Psukim in Vayikra, that God said to us, if you don't let the land rest like I told you to, I'll make sure the land rests. And therefore, 70 times we didn't keep Shemitah, 70, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent us into Galus, and the land lay desolate for 70 years, and made up those 70 Shemitah. So you see that, according to the Tanakh, in the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, now if you do the math, from the time of Yoshua until the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, is a lot more than 70 Shemitah. So I guess we kept some and not others, and I'm not sure exactly what it means. I don't know if it means nobody kept it, or some people kept it, some people didn't. But if we have some kind of romantic notion that the Jewish people has always been very holy, and it's only in our generation that people aren't keeping the Torah, that's not true. And we're told that very clearly. In the second Beit HaMikdash, we have, it could be the things were a little bit better. I mentioned it earlier, and there are some other historical sources that we know that Shemitah was kept, sometimes at great difficulty. But we also know that Shemitah wasn't always kept properly. And one of the ways we know that is because of one other important halakha that I want to mention, called the Isur Svichin. Okay, we used the word Sviach before. We said that Svichin means things that grow on their own during Shemitah. Like, for example, if you have a vegetable patch or a wheat field where you've been growing things for previous years, and even if you walk away from the land completely, the things that grow during Shemitah are in principle mutar. However, the rabbis, the Rabbanim, prohibited them. Anything that would have needed to be planted during Shemitah, anything that would have needed to be planted, so not things that grow on trees, not fruits, but grains or vegetables that would have needed to be planted, midrabanan, even though minatorah they're mutar if they grow on their own, midrabanan you're not allowed to eat them. That's called isur svichin. And the reason the rabbis made this is, so you have it here in the Rambam, I believe. No, I didn't put it on the page, but I asked for the glass of his Rambam. I'll just tell you outside. Apparently people were cheating. People were going out to their fields, maybe at night or when no one was looking, and planting some seeds. And then a few months later, oh, look at that! It grew on its own, amazing! And they were getting peyot shvi'it. That way the rabbis found out of this and made it mister derabbanan. Even if it grew on its own, it's aser. Okay, which means that this doesn't apply yet, halacha l'masa, because the vegetables that we get now, right, it takes more than 2 days or 3 days for a vegetable to grow. So a cucumber or a tomato that you have now was planted a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, probably. But as we get later into the Shemitah year, when the vegetables that hit the market are vegetables that were planted after Shemitah, regardless of who planted them, if they're peirot shvi'it, they're asur ba'achila. Or even if no one planted them, they'd be asur ba'achila. Midrabanan, that's called isur svichin. So we say that even in past generations, Shemitah wasn't always observed the way it's supposed to be. In the 1880s, after the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, or maybe after a few hundred years after, let's say after the period of the Mishnah and the Gemara, there was basically no Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael. With the exception here and there, in Sfat 400 years ago, there were some Jewish farmers, and a lot of the discussions we have in the time of the Beit Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, much of the modern conversation about Shemitah goes back to then, a little bit in the 18th century, but really the major discussions began in the 1880s. When Jews, some of them from right here in Yerushalayim, left the walls of the old city of Yerushalayim and went to start some of what became the modern state of Israel, Petach Tikva. was started by some Jews here from Yerushalayim, who went and founded what was then a small farming community, today a big city called Petah Tikva, Motza, just shortly here outside Yerushalayim, Rosh Pina up north, and others. These were some of the earlier settlements, and these were agricultural communities where the Jews went out to work the land. And after a couple of years, it became the first Shemitah. 1882 was the first time this question really came up. In 1882, the people basically just kept Shemitah. They just didn't work the land. But by 1889, when there were already some, 15 or so settlements that had been founded, and people had come from Chutz La'aretz to what we call the first Aliyah, to settle these communities, the question came up, what are we going to do? And you have to understand, you mentioned Pikuach Nefesh, okay? I don't know how much you've learned about the history of those years, okay? But conditions here were very, very difficult. They were trying to drain the swamps. People were dying of malaria. People were on the verge of starvation. They had managed to get some farms going just a few years earlier, and there was a very real fear that if we just stopped farming the lands, that, first of all, people could die of disease or starvation, that the communities would just collapse. People might have to go back to Chutz La'aretz, and some people had come from, had run away from pogroms in Russia and didn't have anywhere to go back to. And plus, there was a whole question, we're trying here to settle Eretz Yisrael, and what's going to happen if we leave the lands that we started to, that we cleared the lands and we plowed the fields and we planted for a couple of years, if we walk away, the local Arabs are just going to come and take over the fields. It's a very, very serious question what to do. And this question was brought before the great Gedolim of that time, both in Europe and here in Yerushalayim. And a big machloket developed. Some of the great rabbis of that time, led by Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and also some of the other great rabbis of that time, Rabbi Shmuel Mohaliver, and a few others, signed on a document endorsing a concept known as Heter Mechira. Heter Mechira already had oranges a few hundred years earlier. The Beit Yosef had discussed such a thing in Sfat a few hundred years earlier. And the concept is very simple. The details are very complicated, but the concept is very, very simple. The concept of Heter Mechira said that they told the Jewish landowners that it would be permissible for them to temporarily sign a document, temporarily selling their land to a goy. Okay, this is similar to what we do with the chametz for Pesach, right? I'm a Jew, I own a farm. If I keep the farm during Shemitah, I'm not allowed to work the land. So instead, I sell the land to a goy on paper. Now the goy owns the land. He's a goy. The land has no kedusha, according to the accepted psak, although that's a very complicated halakhic debate, but that was the psak, according to those who supported it. The land has no kedusha. The goy is allowed to work the land. And then the goy, so on paper, hires me, the Jewish landowner, to be his worker. So instead of being the owner of the land, I'm now an employee of the goy who owns the land. And he hires me to manage the field for him, in theory. He owes me all this money that he's going to have to pay me after Shemitah. I'm not allowed to work the land myself. The rabbis who allowed the heter just allowed me to do certain things, basically melachot d'rabbanan myself. I'm going to have to hire other goyim, right? I'm just the manager. The goy owns the land, and I have other goyim that are working the land. And that way, the rabbis who endorsed the heter allowed Shemitah to continue. And they said this is really a loophole. It's really, really not a good thing, and it's somewhat questionable halachically, and it's terrible philosophically. Look what we're doing. We finally came back to Eretz Yisrael, and now we're going to sell it to a goy so that it doesn't have kedusha, so we don't have to keep the mitzvah. But they felt that it was a dire situation, and they said, for this Shemitah, we're going to allow it. In 7 years, we'll have to have the conversation again. Other rabbis at that time strongly disagreed, including the Rabbanim, chief rabbis of Yerushalayim at the time, Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, Rabbi Shmuel Salant, and the Brisker Rav later on also, they were strongly opposed to the idea of the Heter Mechira, and they did not allow it. That debate has continued every single Shemitah since 1889 to today. Later on, you've heard the names of Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish. A few Shemitah later, they were on the two sides of this. Rav Kook, when he came, before he was the chief rabbi of all of Eretz Yisrael, he was the chief rabbi of Yafo, and he was in charge of a lot of the agricultural communities that were around Yafo. He endorsed and even expanded the Heter Mechira, and the Chazon Ish, who was in Eretz Yisrael at the same time, was strongly opposed to the Heter Mechira. But both Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish felt that we have to find ways to allow farmers to continue to run their fields during Shemitah. Rav Kook endorsed the Heter Mechira. We'll get to the Chazon Ish in a minute. I know I'm basically over time, but I'm taking those 3 extra minutes I had, or 4 extra minutes, and we'll be done. Until very recently, these have been the 2 primary models: those who allow the Heter Mechira and those who don't allow the Heter Mechira. Now, the question of whether to do the Heter Mechira or not do the Heter Mechira fundamentally belongs to the farmer. Right? Should he, and is he even allowed to sell his land to a goy in order to continue to work it during Shemitah or not? If you accept the Hetem Mechirah, he's allowed to. If you don't, you're going to have to figure out what this poor farmer should do. But what does that have to do with you and me? Let's say someone does the Hetem Mechirah. According to those who hold that the Hetem Mechirah works, and most of the vegetables, Ad Hayom Hazeh, most of the farms in Israel, 90%, that's the exact number, 90% of the farms in Israel over the last week were sold on paper through the Rabbanut to a goy. Technically, there's some goy somewhere who owns almost all the agricultural land in the entire country. It might be the same guy who owns all the chametz in the country for 7 days every year. I don't know. What?
I think he's famous. I think he's a famous guy. They do it year after year.
It could be, yeah. And, yeah, he's a guy who's also, they go to a Druze guy who's high up in the army. He accepted upon himself Shefa Mitzvah, but I know also, it's also, you're right. But the bottom line is, so on paper, he owns all the land. Therefore, he's not Jewish. Therefore, according to the Heter, basically everything goes on as usual. The fruits have no Kedusha, and everything's permissible. On the one hand, if you accept the Heter, it makes everything very easy. On the other hand, everything I just talked about, and the beauty of Kedusha Shemit and all that is, we've come back to Eretz Yisrael, and we've turned Shemit into something that remains purely theoretical. There are those who don't accept the Heter, Mithurah. For reasons that I can't go into now, there are questions of whether it actually works. And if it doesn't work, so then what would be the context if it doesn't work? Fruits that grow on trees would still be permissible. According to most poskim, including Shlomo Zalman Orbach, there is no such thing as a fruit that is also to eat because of Shemitah. The only question is if it has Kedusha or doesn't have Kedusha. But a vegetable, because of the Isra Svichin that I mentioned a minute ago, a vegetable will, not yet, but in a couple of weeks, right? So if you go into a restaurant, okay, let's talk tachlis now. If you go into a restaurant, not now, let's say in Hanukkah time, you go into a restaurant and you order french fries. Those fries are made from potatoes by Hanukkah, or maybe a month or two after Hanukkah. It'll be made from potatoes that were planted during Shemitah. Understand what that means. That means a Jewish farm in Eretz Yisrael. Some guy got on a tractor, plowed the field, and planted potatoes now. This week, probably. Somebody's doing that, and those potatoes are going to be in your french fries in a few months. If you buy Heter Mechira potatoes. What if you don't want to accept that? And if you don't accept that, those potatoes are ushered because it's a Svichim, so what are we going to do instead? So until recently, there's only been one other option, one other practical option. And that is, you have to buy from non-Jews. Who are the non-Jews we can buy from? Either local non-Jews, which are basically Arabs, or we could bring it in from other countries. We could import from Kutzlaritz. In theory, we could import from Jews in Kutzlaritz too, but there aren't too many Jewish farmers anywhere else. Right, so we can bring in from Europe or from other places in the world. And that is what has been the practice among those who didn't accept Heter Mechira at all until recently. That is the practice that's followed in most of the Haredi communities and all the badats, as they're called, hashgachot, that's what they're doing. On the one hand, as far as Shemitah is concerned, perhaps things are better. They're being stricter, so to speak. But you have to realize, again, Shemitah is not about you and me. If we do that, first of all, there's a whole lot of issues involved with buying from non-Jews, and the economic damage it can cause, and in some cases the security damage that it can cause, and the health damage that it can cause at times, can be very, very significant. But it's also only possible because only certain people are doing it. There's no way that the Arabs in this country, with the amount of fuel that they currently have, can feed the entire country. It is, if everybody in this country would say we don't want to rely on Heter Mechira, it can't be done. It's not enough. The Arab farmers, the government increased the water allotment to Arab farmers by 30% for Shemitah. I want you to understand what that means. Arabs that are growing vegetables here are getting extra water this year, so they can. So the Jewish farmers who are trying to stay in business aren't going to be able to sell their stuff, and there are people that are going to buy from the Arabs instead. But even that's not going to be enough. And again, the person who buys from the Arab might feel that he personally is not in violation of any Isser Svichin, and that may very well be true, but we haven't solved the problem of these farmers. Maybe the answer is we should all be keeping Shemitah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give us a bracha, perhaps. But in modern times, it's just a lot more complicated. A lot of things are going for export, etc. In my last minute, I want to mention there's a concept that until recently, it goes back to the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish endorsed this concept. This was his alternative to the Heter Mechira, but until recently it's been only available on a very small scale, and today it's much more widely available. And that is what's called Otsar Beitin. Otsar Beitin goes back to the question I was asked before. You asked me, let's say it's really hard, you know, most of the apples in this country are grown in the Golan. Okay, so let's say all the apple farmers said everything's hefker, it's fine. Anyone wants to take it. That's great, but every time I want an apple, it means I have to go up to Golan. And when I go up to Golan, I'm allowed to pick more than one apple, but I'm only allowed to pick enough for my family for a couple of days, right? So I can take a whole tiyul to Golan, I can pick a basket of apples, and I can come home, and next week we need more apples. I'm going to go back to Golan. That's great. I love the Golan. I'll go to Golan every week. But meanwhile, you know, the dates are not grown in the Golan. They're grown in other places, and oranges are grown in, you know, in a third, but we're going to just spend the whole year running around the country. How are we going to do that? And on top of that, modern agricultural techniques require a lot of work to be done. The farmer who says, I'm doing Shemitah, says, fine, I'm walking away. He's not going to water. It's allowed. It's mucher to water the trees. We saw that. But he's not going to water his fields if he's not going to. It costs him money, right? Who's going to pay for that? There's a concept that was endorsed in the Chazon Ish based on a Tosefta. The Rav Kook also accepted this concept based on a Tosefta called Otsar Beit Din. And the concept is that what we do is, we set, and this is a loophole also, make no mistake about it, this is also a loophole. We appoint a Beit Din, which basically represents the entire community, and the Beit Din takes over the field on behalf of Am Yisrael. The farmer says, okay, I'm walking away from my field. It's Hefker. The Beit Din comes along and says, on behalf of the Jewish people, we're going to take over this field. We, the Beit Din, are going to make sure that things are done in this field to get the crops to grow. And then, since the apples are in the Golan, and people in Yerushalayim want apples, we're even going to bring them to Yerushalayim and give them out in Yerushalayim. Okay? We're a bunch of rabbis in the Beit Din. We need someone who knows what they're doing. We're going to hire a farmer to manage this on behalf of the community. Who's a good farmer to manage this vineyard? Or this apple orchard? The guy who's been running for the last 7 years. So we go to him, we say, now that you made it Hefker, we'd like to hire you and pay you a salary. You're not selling your food. We're paying you a salary. You're only going to be allowed to do what's mutter during Shemitah, following our guidelines, because we're the Beit Din. He agrees. We pay other people. We pay him to take care of it. We pay his water bill also, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually, those things are brought to Yerushalayim, and they're given out to people. Now, the Beit Din has to pay for all this, right? The Beit Din has to pay the farmer. The Beit Din has to pay the water bill. The Beit Din has to pay the truck driver, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How are we going to get money for that? The Beit Din, they don't have any money. What they do is, when you get those free apples, you're going to pay. But you're not buying them. Technically speaking, you're paying a service fee. The service fee goes to pay all those things. In the end of the day, you go in the same store, you pay the same storekeeper, you take home the same sack of apples, which means we're also dealing here with a loophole. But the bottom line is we have a farmer who's now keeping Shemitah. He's doing only what's allowed al pi halacha, and he signs a contract with a Beit Din, and he follows the rabbi's instructions. We have land that was not sold to Goyim. No heter mechira was done, and you have the privilege of eating Kedushat Shavit. Until recently, this has been available only on a very small scale. Today, it's much more widely available. That, and there's also one other, there are also other things that we can do, which I won't go into now, but I'll just mention, right? That Otsa Beitin helps us with fruits on trees that don't need to be planted. It helps us right now with vegetables that were planted a month or two ago. But when those vegetables run out, we can't plant new tomatoes and peppers now. How are we going to get tomatoes and peppers in 6 months? There are some ways to do so, not with Kedusha, but there are ways to do so also. And the primary method is what's called a matzah minutak. It's a modern Hebrew term, where basically what they do is, and it's based on a heter given by the Chazon Ish, they grow these vegetables inside greenhouses and not in the ground. They grow them in flower pots that are on tables or plastic sheets inside a greenhouse, so it's not in the ground and it's not outdoors. And the Chazon Ish ruled that that's mutar, because it doesn't say you're not allowed to grow things in Shemitah. It says the Shavta Ha'aretz. And it says sadcha lo tivra. It's not a field, it's not the land, and therefore there's an organization known as Otsar Haaretz. I wish they would have chosen this name, because it sounds very much like Otsar Beit Din, which is probably why they chose it, but it confuses people tremendously, but that's what they call themselves. They do have a store in the Old City. I don't know where it is. Do you? There is a store. I meant to check. There's a store somewhere in the Old City. You'll see the words Otsar Haaretz. They have these advertisements with a picture of a little boy or a little girl. There's two different ones holding some really nice looking fruits. And one of the makolets here is everything being sold in those Otsar Haaretz stores is grown by Jewish farmers in ways that are permissible in halacha and without using the heter mechira. Some of them are Otsar Beit Din, have Kedushat Shvi. Some of them were grown during methods using other methods that are permissible. But those are basically the three options that you now have. You can use heter mechira, which is endorsed by many, many, many great poskim. You can buy from goyim. And or you can use this third option, which is, in my opinion, certainly the best of the three, although it's still somewhat limited in scope. And it certainly only applies to fresh fruits and vegetables. It doesn't apply to packaged products yet. It's not available in restaurants in most cases yet, etc. That's basically the overview. I did go a few minutes over time. I will stop now, but I'm available for questions. I will stay here as long as necessary. I thank you very much. I also have these books that I wrote. If anyone would like, I have these little booklets here. They're 5 shekels each just to cover printing costs. I'm not making any money on them, but if you'd like this 20-page booklet, you can just come up here and take one, and that hopefully explains things also. Thank you very, very much, and Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Haaretz.